Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
From my own house, I could hear, you know, the Azans mobilizing people to come out onto the streets. There were jets flying overhead. There were bullets in the street. I could certainly hear from my own window. And people basically, you know, confronted the tanks and told the soldiers to go home. And eventually they did.
You're listening to War College, a weekly podcast that brings you the stories from behind the front lines. Here are your hosts.
Hello and welcome to War College. I'm Jason Fields.
And I'm Matthew Galt.
Many people may not realize, but Turkey is actually a relatively new country. It's just shy of 100 years old. It was created as a republic out of the ashes of the Ottoman Empire after World War I, and largely by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, who stuck around as president until 1938. Since then, there have been elected governments, military coups, and now, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and our guest will make sure I pronounce that properly, has reshaped the country in his own likeness, or at least how he likes. To help us make sense of it all, we've invited Andrew Finkel onto the show. Finkel has been a journalist based in Istanbul since 1989, corresponding and freelancing for a variety of print and broadcast media that has included the New York Times, The Times, which, by the way, is the London Times, Time, The Economist, The Guardian, The Observer, CNN, and the Financial Times, as well as Turkish language media. Whew. His popular handbook, Turkey, What Everyone Needs to Know, is published by OUP in 2012. So, Andrew, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for asking me to talk to your listeners.
So, what's it like to live in Turkey right now? Would you call it a free country?
No. But I suppose the thing is, it's never been free. I mean, I don't know if you can hear the azan, the call to prayer in the background here. So at least it shows that I really am in Turkey, not in New Jersey. Well, difficult to answer because there's always been restrictions on public life, restrictions on politics. But I think these restrictions have anything been becoming much more intense in the last 2-5 years. It's become something of a problem to Turkey's development, I believe.
Well, can you sort of talk about Erdogan and sort of what role he's had in the change?
Well, you did pronounce it reasonably correctly. Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who is the now president, formerly prime minister of Turkey, started his life as his political career as the mayor of Istanbul in the mid-90s was mayor at a time when there was his party, which was a religious-orientated party, was really sort of frowned upon and was undermined by the establishment, the military establishment. And he did his very best to overcome those obstacles despite a brief time in prison. And I think his sense of having countered, as it were, attempts to keep him out of politics, to keep him out of public life, including this short spell in prison for reciting a poem at a public rally, has, I think, in his mind, justified his own tactics, which has basically been to push doors wide open when they're a bit ajar and to sort of continue to make progress in taking the reins of power into his own hands until now he's become a president with really unchecked presidential powers, executive powers. One of the key events which allowed him to do this was a failed military coup, an attempted military coup in 2016 in July, and which he used as an opportunity to impose a two-year period of emergency law to rule by decree. So now we see most aspects of Turkish life, the judiciary being the most important perhaps, but the press coming a close second, which is very firmly under the control of the government, and it's the brave judge or the unwise journalist who really makes a point of going against the ruling party or Mr. Erdogan himself or his family.
Just to give people a little bit of background, if you could, Turkey, it was a very secular state, right? I mean, it's Muslim predominantly, but the state set up by Ataturk was supposed to be very secular. Is that correct?
But it's correct and not correct. It's a state in which religion has been instrumentalized, in which religion has really been under the control of the state. But being under the control of the state doesn't mean that it was purely secular. So you have, as you had in the Ottoman Empire, you had a Sheikh of Islam, you had a state-appointed Islamic cleric. In the Republic, you have had a state-appointed director of religious affairs who basically, kept his eye on religion. So it's not so much that it's a secular state; it's a state in which religion is kept under the control of the state. Under the current government, we've seen a vast expansion in the powers and influence of the director of religious affairs. So perhaps religion is more prominent. Certainly the early Republicans were much more skeptical, much more mocking, I suppose, of the religious observance of the people. And that indeed was used against them as a populist means of other political parties coming to power. But this is, there is certainly a section of society which regards itself as secular, which would like to see religion, not so prominent in public life and just, confined to the private beliefs of its citizenry. But that is certainly less and less the case in contemporary Turkey.
Can you give us the background on the 2016 coup attempts? Like, who were the players? What happened? How did it shake out? My strongest memory from that, watching it, is Erdogan, I believe on Facebook Live, broadcasting, saying that he was still in power, and then nobody had taken him down or was going to take him down. And I remember watching it at the time and thinking, like, oh, this isn't a good look. The leader of a country kind of making his case to the people via social media while the tanks kind of encroach, but he won. Right. And what was the aftermath of that?
Well, it's certainly a curious incident, and one which, we certainly have an official version of what happened, but we, because, the press is under the control, is under the, very closely monitored in Turkey, we haven't had, many independent voices sort of going around and nosing around to find out exactly what happened. Many commentators, including myself, I am embarrassed to admit, had said that a military coup in Turkey was not possible in a society as complex as Turkey, and in which, how do you, in the old days you could occupy the radio station, but how do you occupy the social media? How do you, how can you control a population in a modern state or just sort of impose your will over them with a tank in front of a public building? It just wouldn't work, I don't think, and the economy was so complex that any attempt to really control Turkey by force wouldn't result in the impoverishment of its people, and that, you know, the coup makers would have to bear that responsibility. So I never thought that such a coup was possible. But I suppose in a way I was right, because it failed. And what appears to have happened that night is that there was certainly a faction within the military. That faction, the government very strongly says, was manipulated and controlled by an exiled cleric, someone who lives in the United States in upstate Pennsylvania, called Fethullah Gulen, who had a fairly widespread and powerful movement in Turkey, and clearly was attempting to move his people and his followers into influential positions within the government. At a very early stage, well, not at an early stage. At one point, they had been supporters of the government. The government, these were people who basically recruited and made their influence known by having a network of schools both inside Turkey and abroad, and so they tended to be sort of more sophisticated, better educated than the government's own supporters, and were put in positions of power, possibly in the military as well. So increasingly, Erdogan began to see them as a rival to his own power, as a sort of state within a state, and made various decrees, methods, put pressure on them, basically to make their life very difficult. So it is entirely plausible, though, you know, that we only have, you know, who knows what the actual reality was, but it seems very plausible that certainly one of the factions trying to overthrow the government was this disgruntled sect, which had once been very powerful and was no longer so powerful. The coup seem to have not been particularly good at making coups, whoever was responsible. The plot went off early. It should have gone off at, you know, after midnight, when everyone was in bed and people would wake up to a coup. Instead, it seems that the government got wind of it. It maybe even sort of allowed it to unravel in a controlled fashion so that they could control it. And of course, there are many people who think it was a false flag operation, that there wasn't really a coup at all, or at least there was only a little bit of a coup, and that the government played it to their advantage. But as I say, we don't really know exactly what happened that night. But certainly what did happen was that there was a great popular reaction to it. You know, from my own house, I could hear, you know, the Azans mobilizing people to come out onto the streets. There were jets flying overhead. There were bullets in the street. I could certainly hear from my own window. And people basically, you know, confronted the tanks and told the soldiers to go home. And eventually they did. And so the next morning, the coup was really a complete collapse, a complete failure. There really wasn't a popular support for it, and then the people had really bravely had told this incredibly stupid coup plotters to mind their own business. But in the aftermath, of course, there was a huge crackdown on the Gulen movement or anyone whom the government could really identify as an opposition member and brand as a member of the Gulenist sect. So in the aftermath of the coup, there was a huge, you know, crackdown. I think 150 publications were shut down, you know, I think the figure was 170, 150 journalists initially arrested, scores of civil servants, military people, teachers, people in every walk of life suspected of having Gulenist affiliations were dismissed. So there was a very much a sort of purge of public life, and the result of that purge, I think, is that the government has emerged much more powerful than before.
Can you explain who Gulen is? Because I think that's pretty important to the story and to Erdogan's power, because in many ways, the Turkish, like, he's kind of this boogeyman, right? Can you kind of give us the background on him?
Well, I did meet him once. at the opening of a bank. One of his one of his, not really a bank, a sort of non-interest bank, which his followers were opening. He essentially was. I have to say I don't know his life story all that well, but he was a cleric who had a following, very much a firebrand teacher. He had sort of two sides to him. He could be a very emotional and powerful and moving speaker in front of his own followers, but he was very diplomatic and a statesman like in other contexts. I mean, the one time I met him was, I said, at the opening of this bank, and this was when the group was at their heyday, and that present at this opening was the mayor of Istanbul, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, one of the man who was to become the president of the republic within Erdogan's party, Abdullah Gül, Tansu Çiller, who was the finance minister at the time. So, many politicians courted the influence which he had over his public, and he essentially had this strategy of, basically building institutions, which I think was, and working within the state, which was a sort of novel approach. Certainly, I mean, there have been many what they call tariqat sects, religious orders within Turkey, but this one seemed to be particularly successful in as much as it embraced modernity and was very sort of nationalist, Turkish nationalist in its own way, but very much about, educating, recruiting the best and the brightest and educating them and getting them into positions of power. So it was quite a shrewd operation. Of course, it was worldwide. There were Gulenist schools and plenty of them in America. I think there still are, though. I think, at one point there were 100 some odd countries which had these Gulenist schools. And the government sort of relied on this Gulenist movement as a sort of cultural ambassador to various countries. So, typically a Gulenist school would open up in, Senegal or the Ivory Coast, this would be followed by the opening up of a Turkish consulate, the opening up of a flight agreement with the national airline, and Turkish businessmen would come in and out. So they were very much a sort of what appeared to be an element of Turkish soft power on which the government at the time relied on, but I guess they had too much power. And possibly history, when we finally get to see the documents and understand exactly what went on the night of July 15th, 2016, perhaps they abandoned soft power for hard power. But it's a curious story. Fethullah Gulen is still alive, living in Pennsylvania, I think, which is a very odd thing. I mean, I remember participating in a 60 Minutes program, and the 60 Minutes researchers had spent, months and months trying to dig the dirt up on this man and what his influence was and why he was, so powerful and what he was doing in America. And at the end of the day, the story they presented was, was a sort of Ripley's Believe It or Not. Here is this, cleric who has all this power, and believe it or not, he lives in, the Pennsylvania Dutch country. that was sort of the best they could do. So it was a fairly, movement which kept its own counsel, I suppose.
It's interesting because from the point of view of the United States, first of all, there's the refusal to extradite him to Turkey, and Turkey's been trying to get him returned to that country for years now, right? It's so hard to really understand the story, and I'm really grateful that you told it. It just seems like a weak old man who's being hounded. I think a lot of people in the United States looked at it that way.
Yes, I suppose. I mean, I have to say I was, you know, never under his spell, so I have no, I don't really quite understand what the charisma that he's meant to have had and the attraction that allowed him to maintain this huge following. And maybe my Turkish isn't good enough, I don't know, he clearly did have a very loyal and religious following. I mean, at one level, it was, you know, what he represented was a sort of what people used to call, you know, moderate Islam or whatever. I mean, he one of his messages, certainly at one point in the movement's history, was that of religious tolerance. And so they would, you know, they would have these breakfast meetings during the holy month of Ramadan, and they would have meetings, and they would invite as many people from as many different walks of life as possible, and the chief rabbi and the ecumenical patriarch, Greek Orthodox patriarch, the Armenian patriarch, they would all be invited to this dinner as evidence of this great tolerance. Sadly he died, but I can, the Armenian patriarch at the time in Turkey was, you know, I remember meeting him once at the beginning of the year, and he said, isn't it great, all this, you know, tolerance and this and that and the other thing and understanding. And then I ran into him again at the end of the year, and I think basically, to paraphrase, he said, if someone mentions the word tolerance once more, I think I'll throw up, you know. So there, you know, there was a sort of, I don't know, this certainly belief in tolerance was also very much to create a space for Islamic observance in public life in Turkey, where it had not been able to. So, you know, there was a point in Turkish history not all that long ago when, you know, women couldn't wear headscarves and have a higher education, or couldn't get a job in a public office if they dressed in Islamic garb. So, you know, clearly there was a sense of grievance, which they also, not just the Gulen movement, but the government itself represented.
Can we talk for a minute about the press? One thing that we read about in the States all the time is a newspaper being shut down, or another newspaper being shut down, or dozens of newspapers being shut down. Can you talk a little bit about what it's like to be a journalist there, and also what it takes to run a newspaper in Turkey?
Yes, I can. I mean, they're not, you don't read about it so much anymore because they've all been shut down. Yes, I mean, well, let me go back a bit. I mean, this is the subject sort of dear to my heart. I mean, basically, the Turkish press has never been, you know, the sort of standard bearer of truth and objectivity and holding, you know, power to account. There's always been an element of compromise with authority and people, you know, trading headlines for land deals and cheap state land and privatization contracts. So that, you know, basically as the press retained more, became more influenced, particularly during the 1990s, when there was a series of unstable coalitions, and, you know, the press barons really did have a great deal of brokerage power and used that brokerage power both to put governments in power, but also to sort of promote their own non-media business interests. But the metaphor I use is that the media during the 1990s was a bit like, you know, the sort of corrupt policeman. You know, if you're a crooked cop all the time, you go to jail, you know, so the thing about a corrupt policeman is that they know when to be corrupt and when to uphold the law. It's, you know, it's an art. So in order to be able to sort of peddle influence, you have to have influence in the first place. So you have to have some sort of integrity. You know, you have to have a sort of modicum of integrity, otherwise nobody buys your newspaper, and therefore nobody respects you, or that newspaper doesn't have any power. So it's a, you know, it was a balance which the Turkish media was very you know, adept at maintaining. What I suppose the most interesting thing is that this government came to power at elections in 2002 without any really major press support at all. I mean, they basically had no large media backing. The reason they got into power was, again, not because they tapped into the religious sentiments of the people, but because there was a huge economic crisis in 2001, and people were seriously impoverished, and there was a wholesale rejection of the whole post-war generation of politicians. Basically, you had one of the things was these media barons in the certainly in the 1990s. It was very lucrative to have a banking license because there were such high rates of inflation that if you had basically a banking license, was you would take money from depositors, you would lend it to the government, and collect the spreads in between. And it was, basically you and I could have been a banker in those days. It was a fairly straightforward business. But what happened in 2001 is that there was this huge devaluation crisis. Suddenly banks couldn't repay the money they'd borrowed in foreign currency. And so a third of GDP just sort of evaporated in these failed banks. And many of these banks, of course, were owned by newspaper proprietors. And those proprietors, quite rightly, not simply lost their banks, but also lost their newspapers, because the board, which was overseeing the public debt, basically took the assets of these people. So you had, you had banks and newspapers with, $1 billion worth of debt, $3.6 billion worth of debt, huge numbers in an economy at the time, which was, maybe a quarter of $250 billion. So there was very little respect for the media, and certainly very little respect within the government for the media, because, these were people who had betrayed them and betrayed the country. There was really very little popular empathy with defending media and the freedom of the press. So this is, this is quite a good warning to lots of other countries, I think. And what happened was, of course, when the media assets were taken over by the banking regulatory agency, they were redistributed. And funnily enough, many of the large media groups went into supporters of the government and cronies of the government and people who build airports and get government contracts and, whatever. Suddenly, from having an oppositional press, you had a press that was, I think, the expression people use is captured, a press that was captured by the government. So, by the mid-2000s, the government, from having no loyal press group to back it, had, a very substantial coalition of media at its disposal, including the state-run media and the Anatolian agency, the quasi-state news agency, semi-independent news agency, now really not semi-independent at all. And the government continued to consolidate those gains and consolidate and make it really much more difficult for independent newspapers to survive. So essentially, stop me when this gets boring, by the way. Newspapers worldwide, the media worldwide was facing a particular crisis that as the internet became more prevalent, people were less inclined to pay for content. So it became more and more difficult to keep the media afloat because people didn't want to pay for the papers anymore because they could, just click on a web page.
Don't have to tell us about that.
Same
thing in the United States, and Matthew and I have worked at enough publications that are on their way out.
I realized tapping into a tale of but you can see in Turkey this was compounded, because not simply were you facing an industry that was being devalued worldwide, but the corrupt media, the pro-government media, had a particular advantage because they didn't really need to make money out of their newspapers. They could, the media was a loss leader for the airport they were building or the contract they were getting. So it was, so they really had no incentive to be independent or critical at all. And of course this, but this escalated. Then we, again, if you want to ask another question and stop this, do.
I have a follow up, but I want you to finish your thought first.
Okay, but my thoughts go on for quite a while, so you be careful what you wish. I think a critical point in this development was in 2013, and around this time of the year in 2013, when there was a public protest in support of maintaining a park in the middle of Istanbul, Gezi Park, stopping it from being developed into a shopping mall. And there was an occupation and suddenly, you at one point that occupation was fairly brutally put to an end. This sort of unrehearsed, spontaneous movement in the middle of the city really posed a sort of ontological threat, I think, to the government, who sort of thought that history was on their side, that everything was going their way, and then suddenly here was this movement which they didn't understand and couldn't control. And of course the weapon that these street protesters had was social media, which was something that hadn't really, dawned, I think, upon Turkish politicians before then. So, the number of tweets per second was fantastic, and people, would know that there was a Panzer car waiting around that corner because, they could see it on their social media. So suddenly you have this, this confrontation between a government which was successful in capturing the old heritage media being faced with social media, which it just really didn't understand and couldn't come to terms with. And at one stage, Twitter was banned before the general election, I think in 2014. And you had YouTube, which was banned for some specious reason for 2 years. And I mean, we even had Wikipedia was access was being denied to Wikipedia until really quite recently after a 2.5 year hiatus. Suddenly the battleground shifted and public, how public opinion is created and it shifted as well. So, the new, there's no point. Again, it's like my metaphor is, Midas and the golden touch or whatever. He could turn everything he wanted into gold, but that included the food he needed to nourish himself. But if you can control the media, but you can't really ensure that when you control the media, that it still acts as a conduit of information in a way of influencing people's opinions. So at present, post-attempted coup, post a series of events, the government controls maybe 80 or 90% of branded media in Turkey. And yet, at a municipal election last year, they pretty much lost every major city in the country. So how does this happen where you control everything but control nothing?
Is this something that you feel in your day-to-day? Like, is it... Do you feel like you're in danger doing your job? Is it something that you worry about? Are you kind of, do you pick your words carefully?
My job has changed slightly. I mean, I'm no longer the boy correspondent I was when we first met. I work with an NGO at the moment, and one of the things that we do is to try and defend independent media and try and get journalists, who are in jail and draw attention to their situation, try and get them out of jail, people who don't belong in jail, and try and get justice, the justice system to work. So I'm not really, engaged in day-to-day reporting in the way that I was. So I didn't have that problem. But I think what I'm close enough to the ground to see what happens with other people. And I think, there was a point, I think, when, you know, Turkey was this boom economy, when everything seemed to be going the right way, and, you know, lots of people were coming here, including hundreds of young freelance reporters. And you know, Turkey, you know, was like sort of, I don't know, Paris after the war, Prague after, you know, after the liberation of, after the breakdown of the Eastern Bloc. You know, there are some cities have their moments of great, you know, resurgence and revival. I can remember sort of being asked by the Observer newspaper one year to write this, you know, piece about, you know, Istanbul boom town, you know, and you know, how people would come here from San Francisco and, you know, have to be dragged onto the plane at 4 a.m. because, you know, and the following year, the Observer asked me to write a piece in which they said, oh, you know, the city's become unmanageable. You know, why don't you write a story about that? So I you know, so one, you know, one year you're on the riding the crest of the wave, and the next year you're in the trough. Basically, you had this huge community of freelance journalists, but then, of course, now they found it impossible to operate, and they all left, or quite a lot of them left. But there's still a fairly large journalistic community. So I think the point is that if you have a large newspaper behind you, if you're the FT correspondent, they write for the Economist, the New York Times, or whatever, you enjoy a certain immunity and protection because of the newspaper you're writing for. But, you know, if you don't have that protection, then you're much more vulnerable. There hasn't been that much directed against foreign correspondents. Occasionally it does happen. A photographer here who's, you know, happens to have some pictures on his you know, camera from 2 years ago or something. There have been attempts to intimidate the foreign press and foreign correspondents.
Yeah, I would say that that's we've had quite a few correspondents, war correspondents, foreign journalists that have come on the show. And I would say that there's a through line with Turkey, and everyone has a Turkey story. No one wants their Turkey story to be told on the air. Everyone always tells it after we get off the call, and I've always thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, it's like I've got so many Turkey stories that are not, you know, which ones to keep under the carpet and which ones not to. But because I've been here too long. I mean, I think the point is that certainly, you know, yes, foreign correspondents have their troubles, and we've all have them. I guess the one story I will tell you was my favorite story is this was sort of in the mid early 90s when the sort of, you know, there was great sort of civil unrest and almost insurrection in the Kurdish areas of the country, and I was going to a province where there, you know, they'd been villages set on fire and God knows what, and it was, you know, so we went there and it was sort of impossible to do the story. And at the end of the day, I did the story from Istanbul and interviewed people coming off the bus rather than actually try and talk to them on the spot where they would be observed and watched. But at some point, I went to a restaurant with a Swedish colleague, and we were sitting down, and, you know, we had a little lunch, and the bill came, and it was just, you know, it wasn't a lot, but it was more than I expected. And I you know, I looked at the bill and I said, you know, how come it's so much? And the waiter pointed to this guy sitting in the corner who was the man who was following us, you know, who gave us a cheery little wave because he'd put his lunch on our bill, which we were happy to pay, of course. But I guess that's a slightly flippant view. I mean, what we're concerned about now is that there, you know, I mean, again, it's, we speak up on behalf of journalists, but of course, journalists are not the most numerous victims of injustice in Turkey, but, you know, there are, you know, 100 odd journalists in jail who shouldn't be there. And of course, with COVID raging both outside the prisons and creeping into the prisons. We were very concerned about them. There was an amnesty recently to try and, you know, empty the prison, get rid of about a third of the prison population. And you know, we've seen, you know, gangsters convicted of murder getting out of jail, et cetera, et cetera. But someone who writes a column critical of this or that is still inside jail. So there seems to be a certain vindictiveness towards dissent.
Well, and especially anyone that covers anything that's going on the eastern border, right? And anything involving the Kurds.
But of course, it was always thus. I mean, you know, with the Turkey always had a bad, I can recall writing a letter, you know, a sort of newsletter for the Committee to Protect Journalists about journalists in jail. And just as it published, I realized that I was going on trial. This was in the late 90s. The curse of the CPJ, I used to call it.
Wait, you were going on trial?
Oh, but the, you know, this was another time, another place. This was at the end of the 90s when I was writing for a Turkish language newspaper, and I was deemed to have insulted the military. I mean, they weren't very serious about putting me in jail. They just, although it didn't carry a potential 6-year sentence, so I had to take it seriously. But at the time, it seemed more of a career move than a real threat.
I love that that's an afterthought, though.
I mean, I remember going to a friend's, the news editor of one of the big television stations, his wedding. And this was just when it appeared on the wires that I was going on trial myself. And I guess this was 98, 99, I can't remember. It was like I had completed some fraternity hazing ritual. You know, they said, oh, you know, they're not serious about you. If they really wanted to put, you know, do something to you, they would have put you in this court, not that court, you know, and you know, it was like everyone was one-upping them about which, you know, the trials and tribulations that they had faced. There was always an attempt to use the law to intimidate the media, and mainly it was done through by keeping the proprietors on a short leash, because they you know, if you were too critical of the government, you didn't get your privatization deal, you know, so, or your this or that or the other thing. So, you know, this was always the case in Turkey. But of course, now it's become much more intense, much more dangerous, much more, I can make a joke of my own situation, but I certainly wouldn't joke about someone in jail at the moment where there's, you know, the pandemic raging outside.
All right, we're going to pause there for a break from our sponsors, such as they are. We are talking Turkey. You are listening to War College. We will be right back.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
All right, thank you for sticking with us, listeners. We are talking about Turkey. Well, how has the pandemic affected things in Turkey? How is the state dealing with it? And is it better there than it is in the U.S.? Because things are not great here.
Well, this is, I understand to be the case. I didn't think anywhere is quite as bad as the United States at the moment. Maybe India, I'm not quite sure. There certainly is the virus. I mean, the point is that the government seems fairly confident about its handling of it, and I don't think there's that much public criticism of the way they're handling it. I mean, they have the same, sort of ambivalence that exists everywhere. You know, do you deal with the pandemic or do you deal with the economy? And, you know, how does one balance that particular seesaw? And, you know, there were fairly strict measures, you know, people over the age of 65, of which I am in a member of that cohort, weren't allowed out at a certain point, you know, for several months, I think, because I look so much younger, I managed to creep out. Or we're allowed out on Sundays, you know, it's like the teddy bear's picnic. Younger people were also kept. And there were strange things where during the week you could travel, but at the weekends there was a total lockdown. So there was attempts to slow it down or to do this or to do that. And the death rate is, I think there have been about just over 5,000 deaths in a population of about 70, 80 million. So, you know, it's bad, but not terrible. At the moment, I think people are fairly relaxed, and there's a great chance that it'll, you know, the famous second wave will erupt. But, there's a few things that work in Turkey's favor, or at least I've heard these arguments, and perhaps they're genuine. Is that one? It's a much younger population. Yeah, the mean age in Turkey, I think, is 29 or 30. So, you know, the people who have it are more likely to recover. The second is that there was an explosion in private healthcare, and because ICU intensive care units are so, you know, are high cost, you know, high earning bits of kit, as it were, in the medical profession, there's quite a lot of ICU units in Turkey. And so that there was never a question that there would be a shortage. I don't know. Those are the two main containing factors. And of course, there are a lot of the deaths elsewhere in Europe, particularly were in all in old age homes and care homes. And Turks tend to keep their elderly relatives at home, you know, look after them themselves or not put them into care. So you didn't have this contagion spreading through old people's homes because there aren't that many. But of course the economy is going to contract, you know, maybe 5%. And of course Turkey depends a great deal on tourism. The European Union at the moment is saying that Turkey is not a safe destination. The UK, I think, is the exception to that. You can travel from the UK, but they're Brexiting anyway. And of course, Turkey, you know, it depends on its tourism revenues quite a bit. Its markets, there's both domestic and international demand have slowed down. And so there's going to be, you know, there's a huge amount of pain. The Turkish economy wasn't doing so great before the pandemic. The government's been using its foreign reserves to keep the currency from being devalued completely by making it more difficult to deal in liras, by selling liras on the foreign currency, by selling dollars on the foreign currency market, so to stop speculation against the lira. But of course, the foreign reserves are running down. It's in a very... The economy is very fragile. Maybe things are looking up a little bit from where they were a month or two ago. And most analysts don't think there's a crisis that's going to hit tomorrow or the next day. But, you know, I think, you know, it definitely has weakened the economy considerably. And I think that, you know, people are expecting some serious event relatively soon in Turkey.
Well, I have to say, you were talking about tourism a little bit. you know, I was in Turkey, I guess it's 10 years ago at this point, maybe a little longer. And I just have to say, if you're looking in for signs of the ancient world, there's no place like Turkey. Byzantine, Roman, Greek, it's just fantastic.
Prehistoric. I mean, one of the most extraordinary finds in recent history in Turkey was they were excavating for at a metro station that a train line that would go under the Bosphorus to connect Europe to Asia and subway system. And the thing was held up several years because they came across the harbors of Byzantium, which were under the water, which were sort of no longer under the water, which were under the earth. But just when they were about to sort of, you know, pack up and say, we've done that and excavated that, they found, you know, remains from when there was no Bosphorus, before the Bosphorus had opened, straits had opened, which, you know, put, you know, made the city several millennia older than people had thought it was by discovering these prehistoric graves, which, you know, were sort of with, you know, footprints in them, as it were, which were so perfectly preserved because they, so it's, yes, I mean, of course, one of the attractions of being here is that it's such a, you know, interesting place to be historically, and of course, it's not really boring. The politics are, as messy as they are, aren't really boring either. So both past and present Turkey offers quite a bit.
Speaking of history and messy politics, can you give us a little bit of a primer on, especially because you've been there so long and you kind of have this longer perspective, what is Turkey's relationship to the Kurds on its eastern border, and how has it changed? Where is it now? What's going on?
Well, I'm glad you asked me a short and easy one. It's deeply ambivalent, of course, is the answer. I mean, the Kurds occupy a sort of Bermuda, is it triangle or
yes,
or whatever, all the nations of on Turkey's eastern and southeastern borders have Kurdish populations: Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Turkey, and each country uses the Kurdish population of the people it doesn't like as a weapon against the other. And so, I'm sorry, can you hear the outside my window? There's someone selling beans or something. So there's a left speaker.
It just adds color to the audio. It's fine.
That's good. Sounds like I'm doing a ventriloquist act. Sorry, we were talking about Kurds. And, you know, Turkey has been remarkably unsuccessful over the history of the Republic in providing its own Kurdish populations with some sort of reassurance of their own cultural identity and ethnicity, and was very much keen on assimilating the Kurdish population, and therefore its inability to come to terms with its own Kurdish populations meant it wasn't limited its ability to act as the good uncle, as it were, to in the region, because, you know, how can you deal with other people's problems when you can't deal with your own? So it was always, you know, it was always a running sore in Turkish politics, and, you know, the answer which successive governments gave was that the best policy was really to sort of, electricity and prosperity would make Kurds, you know, want to be part of the Turkish Republic and would, you know, cure them of all this, you know, cultural autonomy nonsense that they had in their heads. But it never really seemed to work. But again, it's the situation is more complicated than many people account for. I mean, you say that there's a problem in the southeast and east of the country, but of course, I'm speaking to you from the city which has the largest Kurdish population in the world. I mean, the city of Istanbul, if you think, you know, 12 or 20% of the population, between 12 and 20% of the population in Turkey are Kurds, you know, in a city of 17 million, you know, that means there's quite a lot of people of Kurdish descent and ethnicity and origins. And yet, you know, again, Istanbul is not, doesn't seem to be a hot spot of unrest. And again, you have a Kurdish minority party in Turkey, which, you know, it has made some mistakes, some big mistakes, but it's also done a lot of reasonable things in terms of, you know, trying to address a broader audience and trying to impress upon the rest of the population that they're trying to solve the Kurdish problem within a democratic format, that it's, you know, it's much better to have this movement inside parliament pissing out, as it were, than you know, a movement which can't, whose aspirations will never be recognized or met. But there seems to be, and at a certain point, I think, you know, the government and Erdogan himself recognized that, you know, there was time to solve what they call the Kurdish question. And you know, there were several overtures were made, and the imprisoned leader of the PKK, the principal, you know, opposition, the armed opposition movement in Turkey, with Abdullah Öcalan, he was enlisted in trying to sort of negotiate a settlement and a peace prospect. But at a certain point, you know, the government found itself losing support, and a much better way of winning back that support was to tap into the nationalists, you know, the Turkish nationalist sentiments of its supporters and of the population. It's now in a sort of de facto coalition with an ultra-nationalist party, therefore, you know, which is, you know, vehemently opposed to any sort of cultural compromise or compromise at all with the Kurdish population. So we find the charismatic, young, charismatic, articulate, and quite, you know, I would say quite sensible, you know, leader of this Kurdish leaning this Kurdish nationalist party, the HDP. He finds himself in jail on bizarre charges. The European Court of Human Rights has said that he's being unfairly detained, but so they immediately rearrested him on something else. You know, the attempt to solve and come to terms with its own population, Kurdish population, has really been abandoned in Turkey for the time being, who knows for how long, which means that it's, you know, it's very nervous of autonomous Kurdish entities on the other sides of its border in Syria and Iraq, and does its best to undermine the credibility and integrity of those countries, of those entities.
So one last question, which is, do you think there are lessons from what's happened in Turkey, the sort of rise of, I hope you don't mind using the word, of authoritarianism or centralization of power. Do you see any lessons for other countries?
Anyone, one beginning with an A?
Right.
Antarctica. Yes, the need for constant vigilance is constant. I think, what we've seen in Turkey is the erosion of liberties, of civil liberties, and you know, it doesn't happen overnight. You know, at one point, you know, this government this party seemed much more liberal and sensible than its rivals. You know, as I said, you know, it was prepared to compromise with Kurdish politicians at a time when no one else was. But I think once you get a little bit of power, you get a little bit more power and a little bit more power. It's incremental, and it's, I think power is very, you know, it's quite addictive, I suppose. It's very difficult to give it up. There's, especially when a lot of people are making a lot of money because you being in power, it's even if you wanted to give it up, it's difficult to give up. That's true. And that, Bashar al-Assad, surrounded by his Praetorian Guard in Damascus, if he wanted to retire and move to Florida, I don't think the people around him would let him. You get yourself into this corner, you create the famous bubble, you create a sort of echo chamber in which, you're always right and everyone's always wrong. Very few people, eventually people lack the courage to try and pierce that bubble, particularly if it lands them in jail or it gets them into trouble or so many things. So, it's a very painful process to watch. And of course, one trusts in the common sense and decency of ordinary citizens who have the sense to reject that sort of self-aggrandizement in excess and become disillusioned with it. And that, of course, creates its own crises because, once you've lost legitimacy in the eyes of your own population, then what do you do? It's very difficult to get off the treadmill. There is no, one lesson to be learned, I think, from the Turkish experience, but it certainly reinforces the need for constant vigilance. Does that answer your question?
It does, Andrew. And thank you so much for joining us this week.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's all for this week, War College listeners. War College is a production of War College LLC. It is me, Matthew Galt, Jason Fields, and Kevin O'Dell. We will be Angry Planet very soon. Very, very soon. Same great show, new attitude, new graphics, new music. If you like us and you like what we're doing, think about going to angryplanet.substack.com, where we write a weekly newsletter that collects a lot of the defense news that falls through the cracks and also some of our own original reporting. You can follow us on Twitter at @war_college and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/war college podcast. We will be back next week with another conversation about conflict on an angry planet. Stay safe until then.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.